morning, Connecticut, and to all our friends across the sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Today, we're going to replay a program from earlier this spring, introducing you to an expanding Connecticut-based human service agency called All Our Kin, which was recently recognized on the national stage and is working to expand its reach, building high-quality, sustainable family child care programs. Then we'll rebroadcast a road trip we took to our farm in Bloomfield. We're going to hear about all the exciting activities going on at the farm for state residents and students and talk about new opportunities to get you out on the farm in 2016. And since this proposal became law following the latest legislative session, we'll replay a chat with AARP discussing the successful implementation of a bill designed to help even more Connecticut residents get started saving for retirement by requiring even the smallest businesses to provide payroll deduction savings plans. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this news. There's always something wild going on at Connecticut's only zoo. Hey, did you know the Bridgeport Beardsley Zoo hosts weddings? If you know anyone currently looking for a wedding venue, the zoo is offering information and wedding booking details on WeddingWire.com. Learn more about holding one of the most unique and wild weddings ever at the Beardsley Zoo. For details on the many other summer and programs on tap, just call 203-394-6565 or visit beardsleyzoo.org. Well, let it not be said that the award-winning For the People is not occasionally slow to react. In fact, it was way back on October of 2015 when I learned that a Connecticut nonprofit based down in the New Haven area called All Our Kin was selected as the grand prize winner of the Rosalind S. Jaffe Award here in Connecticut. And I am so pleased to welcome Jessica Sager and Jana Wagner, who are co-founders and directors of All Our Kin. All Our Kin trains, supports, and sustains community child care providers to ensure that children and families have the foundation they need to succeed in school and in life. And we're going to start things out with Jessica. Jessica, welcome to the program, and sorry it took so long to bring you guys on board.
Thanks. Delighted to be with you.
There's never a bad time for a good radio interview, though. So let's talk a little bit about the humble beginnings of All Our Kin. How did, from your perspective, how did this whole thing come together?
Yeah, it's funny. It's been quite a journey. Jana and I started All Our Kin about 15 years ago, which is really hard for me to believe now. We started in one housing project in New Haven with about six women and young children. These were parents who were receiving public assistance from the state, but who were really committed to their own children and to their families and wanted to make a better life for other children as well. And we created a model to train these child care providers to set up businesses in their communities where they could offer high-quality learning experiences to children. And the result, as we now see, having grown the program over 15 years, ends up being a triple win, because when we can identify these women who are ready to lead and step up and play this wonderful role as teachers, they build businesses that help them and their families move out of poverty, so their earnings increase, they do much better. They're able to give children the preparation that we know is critical to success in school. So we're talking about really young kids, right? Giving them early literacy, early numeracy, giving them all the preparation they need for entry to school. And then finally, they're making it possible for other parents to go to work, because childcare, as we know, is a huge barrier for parents trying to enter the workforce. So the model built slowly. Six women, six children, one housing project in New Haven. We are now working in four cities in Connecticut, New Haven, Bridgeport, Stamford, and Norwalk. We are working with about 400 of these amazing family child care providers and reaching about 2,400 children and families.
What I'd like to do at this point, Jessica, is give you a break for a moment and just switch over to Jana Wagner and talk to her a little bit about sort of the hands-on of these childcare training sessions. We won't spend too much time with Jana, but we do want to get your perspective, if we could, Jana. What were some of the things that you were seeing, whether it was in your work or anecdotally in the community where you lived, that kind of gave you the idea that you might want to get involved in something that was bigger, that was going to empower women and really make a fundamental difference in the lives of so many children and families?
Sure. Well, I was born and raised in New Haven and to a single mom who struggled to make ends meet. So I knew how hard it was to raise children by herself. And her strength really reminds me of the women that we work with who really overcome insurmountable odds to make a difference in the lives of the children in their community.
Mm-hmm.
I had the opportunity to teach in the Bronx as an elementary school teacher, where I taught third graders, and most of them were ill-prepared to be in third grade reading. Most of them couldn't read and had really been disserved by the public school system. And I had studied early childhood in college and had worked in a child care center. And so I knew the impact that early childhood education, that is, quality early childhood education, really plays in laying the foundation that builds on children's lasting well-being, both mm-hmm. health and education.
Mm.
And really wanted at some point in my life to come back to New Haven. And so when I met Jessica, all these things I cared about kind of came into view. It was working on behalf of women in my hometown, New Haven, focused on early childhood education in a way that we could really eradicate inequality.
Mm-hmm. And from a practical perspective, what are some of the high points that you see resonating most when you're making contact with these parents who are so desperate to do more for their children, like your mom was for you?
I think some of the highlights would be their real interest in children's social and emotional well-being. Mm. So we've been working with them on learning about attachment and why children's first relationships and their relationships with adults matter so much, and why their role as child care provider is so essential in the earliest years, and that if they build that deep connectedness to young children, that lasts a lifetime, and that they could buy all of the toys and fancy books and baby Einstein materials.
Mm.
And the most important thing is actually them. And so that's been work we've been doing for the last couple of years. And then we've also been working on literacy and numeracy, because we know that a lot of the children that we care for don't have as many words. Their vocabulary is really limited. Mm-hmm. And so we talk to our providers and give them the knowledge, the skills, and the child development to really understand why talking, dialogue, language, books, words are important. And so those are two projects that I'm really excited about and that the providers have really found value in, because they are committed to providing school readiness and early opportunities for children, and they care so deeply about the families and children that they serve. They want to make sure that they're doing their best to get them ready for school.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've really worked with them on understanding, what does that mean? What does school readiness look like? What does it look like for babies? Is that even appropriate? What does it look like for toddlers and preschoolers?
Mm-hmm.
And so part of that is around strong social and emotional competencies and a rich language environment.
Excellent. Well, it's if you're just joining us, we're on the line with Jessica Sager and Jana Wagner, who's speaking with us currently. They are the co-founders and directors of All Our Kin. Last fall, All Our Kin rose to the top of more than 2,000 applicants to capture the grand prize, the Rosanel S. Jaffe Award, for their great work, and now have branched out from New Haven to four communities in Fairfield County and looking to move out from that area of the state into other areas served by our radio program. So we hope that you'll take interest if that you're hearing something that you like. If you'd like to get involved, perhaps be a supporter. AllOurKin.org is their website. You can learn all about them. Jana, before we let you go and get back on the line with Jessica, the thing I found interesting is that around 15 years ago, when this whole thing got going for you and she, this was right at that time when early childhood education sort of exploded on the scene as being, you know, the big, new, and critically important thing that's going to pave the way for, you know, millions of children who will benefit from and follow out of this sort of more advanced educational initiative. Was that something that was on your mind? Were you kind of looking outside the boundaries of your hopes and dreams as you were forming All Our Kin in its early days, and seeing that, wow, at the same time, it seems like everybody else from the U.S. Department of Education to United Way to nonprofits and charities and literacy organizations all around the country are suddenly pushing to get children into educational arenas at a much, much younger age, even maybe younger than preschool.
Yes, I think when we first started All Our Kin, there were definitely policymakers and educators who knew the importance of early childhood education. Any teacher of young children, any nursery school teacher, director, they all know the impact that quality early experiences have on young children. I think it still, at that point, wasn't as well-known or considered a potential cure for inequity or for educational inopportunity. But over the past 15 years, you're absolutely right, the tides have changed, and I think that's in part due to the amazing research that's been done on brain development. And we know so much more about babies' brains, as well as children's self-regulation and epigenetics, that really impacts the way we think about young children. And all of the wonderful economic work that's been done that really shows that if you invest in early childhood education, the families aren't the only ones, the families and the children aren't the only ones who benefit, it's actually society. And so I think that message really resonates with all citizens, because they know that when children receive quality early childhood education, they benefit, their children benefit, their neighborhood benefits, and the ripple effect happens.
Excellent.
Jana
Wagner is co-founder and one of the two directors of All Our Kin, based in New Haven and now serving several communities here in Southern Connecticut, looking also to expand their great work. Jana, if I could ask you to hand back to Jessica. Jessica Sager is also with us, the other co-founder of All Our Kin. And we've got a couple minutes left to wrap this interview up. So, Jessica, in the last couple minutes that we have with you folks this time around, Can you just give us an idea of now that the excitement and the glow of the Jaffe Award is now a few months down the road? Where is All Our Kin going from here in 2016 and beyond? And how could the communities and individuals that might be listening to this program around the state or beyond play a role in helping you do more good work with All Our Kin?
Yeah, that's a great question. So our top priority is to keep doing the good work that we're already doing in the communities that we already serve. So, again, engaging with the family child care providers and our youngest children and families in New Haven, Bridgeport, Stamford, and Norwalk. Mm-hmm. So anyone who's listening who may be in any of those communities, maybe you have resources to share. Maybe you have books or toys. Maybe you'd like to connect us to a school system, a great library program. Go on our website, www.allourkin.org, learn about our work, and think about whether there might be ways that you can support these really extraordinary women and even more the children that they're serving. The other thing is that now that we have gotten this award, we are getting a lot of attention, and we are thinking about growing to other communities. We don't know exactly which communities or what that will look like. But if you live in an area that could really use All Our Kin services, we want to know about it. So again, go on the website, get in touch with us, let us know. Here's what's happening in my community. I hope All Our Kin will come. Or in the meantime, what are some things I could do to support children and families in my neighborhood? And we'd be happy to talk with you about doing that.
Excellent. And I know I speak for our two guests when I say that any type of consideration or support in terms of funding that you'd like to put up against that fantastic $100,000 that the Jaffe Award provided last fall, it would just go further toward the great work that All Our Kin is doing through their programs. Child care professionals succeed as business owners, working parents find stable, high-quality care for their children, and their children gain an educational foundation that lays a groundwork for achievement in school and for their entire lives. We want to thank our guests, our newest friends here on For the People, Jessica Sager and Jana Wagner, co-founders and directors of All Our Kin these 15 years. We look forward to speaking with you both again. Thanks for being on the program. So it's a windy day in Bloomfield, so we're taking our mobile studio inside for the award-winning For the People, but that's okay. We're surrounded by windows and great views and good people. Connecticut State Senator Beth Bayh is with us. She is executive director of the 4-H Education Center here at Our Farm, a community resource for education, farming, recreation, and community events. And as I saw as I wound my way up the road to our location here, it really is a sanctuary where you can get outside, you can interact with farm animals, take a hike, work in their gardens, start your own plot. Sign-ups are going on for school classes and summer camp right now. They're preparing for their 40th anniversary celebration. And hey, maybe you want to have a special event or a wedding, and you'd like to have it out in the beautiful countryside here in Connecticut. Well, they'll help you out with that too. We're so pleased to be invited up here by Beth to talk. And as a two-time Connecticut Agricultural Journalist of the Year, it's
wow,
even doubly exciting. So, Senator Bayh, I'll call you Beth, if that's okay.
Yeah, please call me Beth, and congratulations on that award. Yeah,
thanks. Take us through the history of this location. It was a bequest to the operators.
Yes. So this farm in 1972 was given to the Connecticut 4-H Development Fund, which is a nonprofit. Now we mostly call it Our Farm, but the idea was Beatrice Fox Auerbach donated the 120 acres to this organization to be used for educational purposes and for recreation.
And so at what point did the operators decide to turn it into a destination and education site? Was that the immediate intent of the turnover?
Yeah, I mean, I think by 1976, it was really set as a place where schools came for field trips and families came to explore. I think that it's just amazing the generosity of Beatrice Fox Auerbach. We had a talk about her here last night. We found 180 letters between Beatrice Fox Auerbach and Eleanor Roosevelt. And in those letters, you hear Eleanor thanking her for the eggs from the farm. It really was a model farm. And like May, she knew nothing about farming when she got the job because it was a sort of a gentleman's farm. And then it became a model farm. I think like everything she did, she took it very seriously. And then her children and grandchildren donated the farm and continue in many ways to support the farm in her memory.
So what type of work is going on here? I passed some orchards rolling up the hill. Is that part of the property?
Yes, we have seasonal programs in the fall, orchards. We have hay rides into the orchard, and they are now adjacent to a 40-acre state park, which connects directly with, so it's a 160-acre sanctuary. Up where Beatrice used to live, you can still see her houses up there in the park. Where she entertained Eleanor Roosevelt. So the sanctuary is really a great word that you use to describe us.
Folks can continue to come here year round to purchase produce. Do you have a farm market, or do you have people who work the land that participate in that end of the agricultural business?
We actually have a woman named Kelly who runs a CSA out of here, and she sources from a lot of local farmers and meat producers. We are just getting into that business of we're going to be having a farm store open Saturday morning with eggs. We have some pork from some pigs we raised, and next year we're going to raise pigs in the woods, some heritage pigs who can sort of live up and clear the land for us. We have chickens, and next year we're going to be starting turkeys as well. So we are actually getting into the agriculture a bit more in the coming year. And what really is neat is kids from Annie Fisher Montessori Middle School are here every other week. And you might have seen them. They're running to get the sap from the trees. They're splitting wood. They're starting a fire. And they'll be evaporating the syrup all day. They did about a gallon yesterday. It takes all day to make one gallon. You have to boil off 40 gallons. So what we're finding is that we really want the kids to participate in agriculture in a way that they can see it from start to finish. And you think about students from Hartford, they wouldn't be swinging an axe. You know, they're really, you should have seen, they really had a lot to learn yesterday, but they were so excited. They came in this morning and came running in, and that's a really important part of their education.
That's great. And so the kids from the school will have their hands on the process that will turn into bottles of syrup that will then be purchased retail in the gift shop?
No, they're actually using it in their classes right now. We will sell some of it tomorrow. We have a pancake breakfast tomorrow, but that will be over when this show airs. So mostly, you know, it's really fascinating. They have their math classes, they have their English classes, and they have an hour off, and they go, you know, check on the fire, make sure it's hot enough, which is also math. And the evaporation is math and science. This is a kind of learning I think we need more of.
Chopping is physics.
Yes. I mean, and at the same time, we got a new router in there. So there could be 40 computers online at the same time.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I think kids need technology because that's the future, but they also need time outdoors and away from technology, and we provide a great space for that school.
That connection from the clicks to the boiling down. Yeah, clicks to the sticks is there. You can use that actually in marketing. That's fine. Glad we thought of it. It is great. But we talked about one school's participation. You bring 10,000 young people through here every year.
Yes. I mean, yesterday we had so many kids here. We had a cooking class with 15 kindergartners from West Hartford and with a chef to learn about how to make. They made salad. They chopped. They made black bean burritos. They were here. Their parents had to leave them with the chef and the teacher. So we're also trying to get kids to see healthy eating. And then we had 40 kids here from Wintonberry Early Childhood Magnet. And not just they, but their parents come and they did the maple syrup program as well. And then this weekend, we'll probably have 200 people through to learn about the process of making syrup with their kids. So everything we do here has an educational purpose. What we're trying to do now is grow both the agricultural component to make it a little more real, but also the recreation component. We've developed more trails just to get people out on the farm and families and older people. We have a lot of senior citizens who live near us, and you see them walking often, just watching the birds. Like we have bluebirds winter here. There are almost no other places where bluebirds winter in Connecticut because we have the reservoir in our backyard and we have the 160 acres. So it's pretty cool.
And a little bit of philanthropy, too, in terms of stocking the food share garden or from the food share garden.
Yes. We benefit from philanthropy, and then we also give away 2 tons of fresh local organic food to food share, which is really great. We also have, you know, we have 2 farmers from Jamaica who are growing Kalalua here. In Bloomfield, there's a large African-American and Jamaican population that really wants that. Mm-hmm. And so they get space here to grow that for their family and friends.
Fantastic. That's great. Well, before we take a quick break, there's also an issue I understand, and I apologize, I don't know the status. Last I read, the mushroom barn was in disrepair, and there was a real push to try to raise the funds to re-roof it. Where are you at with that effort at this point?
Well, we have been approved to apply to the 1772 Foundation because we've raised enough matching dollars to go for that. So what we want to do is stabilize that. It's, we think, the last standing ceramic barn in New England. And if you look at it, you wouldn't know it was ceramic. But when you walk up and you see each one are these individual hollow tiles from over 100 years ago, it's pretty cool. So at this point, we're just trying to save the structure. So hopefully we'll be able to finish with that.
Excellent. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back here at the Our Farm to talk to Beth Bai, who is their director here, and also a senator who works and serves here in the region, representing West Hartford, Bloomfield, Burlington, and Farmington in the state Senate right about now, where she's doing double duty. So we won't take a lot more of her time, but we've got about 10 more minutes. So stick with us. We'll be back from Our Farm. If you're interested in finding out more about this organization, please check them out online at ourfarm.org, AUERFARM.org.
Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. This is Director of Public Affairs John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. While there is no one approach to effectively addressing mental illnesses, the Community Innovation Award winners offer best practices for all communities to consider. Now in its third year, the awards program honors local community programs that have successfully introduced novel approaches to address mental health in one of 4 program categories: early intervention, creative use of technology, continuity of care, and service integration. Winning organizations receive $10,000 to further their work, as well as access one-on-one mentoring from past C4MH honorees to learn from other exemplary programs and to facilitate best practice sharing. Entries are due by July 22nd. Learn more about Connect for Mental Health, the Community Innovation Awards, past award winners, and the need for community-oriented solutions to address serious mental illness. Just go to connect4mentalhealth.com. That's connect4mentalhealth.com.
We're back here from the Our Farm, guests of Senator Bai. Beth Bai is the director here at the 4-H Education Center at Our Farm. AUERFARM.org is their website if you'd like to go. Maybe give them a little bit of support in the terms of a financial donation. Maybe designate that donation for the repair and restoration of their mushroom barn or for one of their specific programs or just for general operating expenses. They welcome 10 1,000 local children to the farm throughout the year and host all kinds of activities for folks from Connecticut and perhaps beyond. We're going to talk about a few of the great things going on. And right now for people to listen up, educators, we're going to start with you. School signups are going on right now, I imagine, for the rest of this school year. And I imagine you're already getting some signups for the fall.
Yeah, we get them year-round, but the Farms Produce Food is going on this spring where kids really connect with what's growing and what they eat. We have tractor rides as part of the programs, which the kids just love. You can get to the top of our apple orchard and actually see the whole region. Mm-hmm. And also some rec departments and after-school programs, homeschoolers. We really have kids from 3 years old through high school here. So, you know, as kids need to get out and learn hands-on, this is a place to come.
And it's been around long enough, so I imagine you have kids coming back now, maybe with their own kids, kids who started here back 15, 20 years ago and got the first taste of maybe agriculture or a farm visit here in Connecticut. But also, I imagine, you know, kids are returning from college and maybe wanting to volunteer or work here.
Yeah, we have a lot of volunteers. We have hundreds of volunteers. We are also a workplace for people with disabilities. I mean, we have a young man with autism who takes care of our animals 3 days a week, and he is literally my most reliable employee.
Sure,
he just is so dependable, and he loves the animals, and they love him. And we also work with a couple of other places that are working to get job skills. I had a young woman here yesterday who's learning how to database.
Okay.
And so she has some limitations, but she really likes to work on the computer. And her speed might not be as fast, but she's learning really good skills here. So, you know, that's a really important role for us as well.
Mm-hmm. And tell us what's shaping up for summer camp.
Oh, summer camp, we've got some great things. I think the new thing this year that people will be interested in, the very last week of August when most camps shut down right before school starts, every day we're going to have an 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. day where you say the kids are going to work on the farm. And you can purchase it by the day, and they're going to make their own lunch from the farm. Mm-hmm. They're going to make a family dinner, so every night parents are invited. Come back from work, come here, see what your kids have done all day, and eat with them. So that's the last week of August. But we also have a program specifically for 3 to 5-year-olds, the last 2 weeks in June. And then really we probably will have 100 summer camps that use us as a day trip. And we've added a hike to Hubline Trail this year, which is a full-day experience with a naturalist hiking to Hubline Tower and down, and then having a cookout that we're offering to camps as well, or rec departments, or just, you know, groups that want to go on a field trip. Mm. So we're really focusing this summer on being a support to other camps because, you know, there are a lot of camps out there, and this is just hopefully will help them enhance their programs by working collaboratively.
Yeah. And June 25th is a big day.
Yes, we're going to be celebrating the 40th anniversary of the farm, and the 1976 was when, you know, we really started as a nonprofit, and so we're going to celebrate that this year and have a family-friendly event, but also hopefully raise money to support operations in the honor of Beatrice Fox Auerbach, who is a great philanthropist.
Where it all started. That's great. So, that's okay. So one of the other new things that you're getting into in terms of trying to keep the place viable and sustainable, and not only sustainable, but to acquire enough working capital so you can do improvements and enhancements to what sounds like an already incredibly robust program, event activities and event management are part of the program now here at our farm. Have you guys done any of that yet, or is this something you're also just getting into?
Well, we are going to have a wedding on the weekend of the 4th of July here. A couple is going to be celebrating their vows here. We also have a family where the couple is renewing their vows.
Oh, nice.
So we're excited to do more and more of that. Now that we have renovated space, we have indoor and outdoor space that would be great for weddings, for parties. We already have a lot of school end-of-year parties here, you know, where we have cookouts. Schools use us as a site. And we are a site for things like the Growing Great Schools cooking classes. So, yeah, our facility is a great asset, but it also is a liability, so we have to do events to support it.
Of course. And let's wrap up in the last few minutes that we have, going back all the way around to the educational component, the 4-H component of our farm, is that happening here to the extent that you're actually having competitions from 4-H participants in the late summer and fall fair circuit here in Connecticut?
Yeah, we are growing our 4-H program. I came last weekend. There must have been 20 kids here up with the chickens, getting comfortable holding the chickens and being at the farm. And yes, some of them are planning to show some animals in the fall. As they get older, they're able to show them. But UConn Cooperative Extension just hired Jen Cushman, who has a long history with 4-H and with our farm and is on the board, and she's really helping us do that. And we have a fantastic director in Justin Whitehouse, who just is fabulous with the kids. So it's going to be a good year.
Yeah. And aside from already talking about the mushroom barn and the work that you're trying to do and the grant you're applying for to try to repair and sustain that, are there any other things that are going on here in terms of the physical plant or any capital projects that you're hoping to aim for? Perhaps there's another philanthropist listening to the program this morning.
Well, we've just finished a large capital project in the place where we're sitting, the office and barn space, of about $700,000. But our next move is really our learning center, where the Montessori kids are every day. We need to make that into more modern learning space, and we need to make our kitchen something that's very fluid and can be integrated with the classroom space. So we're applying for some funds and looking to make that classroom a 2016 classroom and a classic farm. So that's about probably all told $100,000 project that is next for us.
Excellent. And finally, Earth Day. That's going to be another event. You've got your 40th anniversary on June 25th, but Earth Day is coming up a little bit sooner. Maybe a first opportunity for folks to come up to the farm and enjoy like a public event, right?
Yeah, we just sort of have an open house on Earth Day to get people outside, and we'll have our hiking trails ready to go with maps for families. Not long trails. They're good for families with young children, but for those up for a longer hike, we have the Metacomet Trail up to Hubline Trail. Up to the Hubline Tower, excuse me. And so, and the animals will be out, and we'll have some baby animals and baby ducklings and kids, et cetera. Kids that, not children.
Yes.
So it'll be a great day. Just a sort of an open day up here.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate the invitation, and I hope our listeners throughout the state take an opportunity to not only visit our farm here in Bloomfield, but also take advantage of the opportunity to visit the hundreds of different working farms, wineries, agriculture and aquaculture locations throughout Connecticut. Many, many millions and millions of dollars in state revenue are generated through Connecticut agricultural enterprises and aquaculture enterprises. And it's something we haven't spent enough time working on our radio program. We've been so concentrating on health issues and social issues over the past couple of years. We're glad to be back on the farm and to start off our kind of junket of Connecticut agricultural locations here at Our Farm, AUERFARM.org. OurFarm.org is their website, whether it's for school groups or summer camp to attend their 40th anniversary celebration or to take advantage of their event and event management capacity or just to come on up and take a hike, buy some eggs, check out their gift shop, or get involved with your kids and family in education. It's a great place. We hope you'll come up and check it out, AUERFARM, OurFarm.org here. And thanks for having us, Senator Bai.
Thank you.
Well, if you were listening a couple of weeks ago, we had State Senator Tony Huang on the program talking about some of the stuff going on at the State House, giving us a little bit of an eye inside the Capitol as this really, really crazy session of the legislature is rolling out. We are coming back to the subject of stuff going on in Hartford right now with an old and dear friend. John Erlingizer is with us. He is with AARP Connecticut. He is his title is what is it? ASD is that assistant something of advocacy?
Close. Associate State Director.
Associate State Director of Advocacy, John. Now we're specifically here to talk about one subject and its implications. That is House Bill 5591, an act creating the Connecticut Retirement Security Program. So, John, part of the reason that AARP reached out and asked to bring you onto the program was that there's a lot of misinformation or misconceptions going on out there. So let's start our conversation just by kind of unpacking what House Bill 5591 actually would do for state residents who are affected by it, if it is initiated.
Sure, John, and thanks for having me on. But House Bill 5591 is a bill that's been worked on for over 2 years, extensive study and research with consultants from the Boston College Center for Retirement Research and other places. And in essence, what this bill would do would give payroll deduction savings access for retirement to the approximately 600,000 people in Connecticut who currently have no way to save for retirement at work. Those are people whose job provides them with no pension, no 401k, or any other device to save for retirement at work. And that's about 600,000 people. And so what this piece of legislation would do would require businesses of five or more to offer a payroll deduction savings opportunity to those employees. Now, that does not mean they're creating 401ks because businesses won't contribute to these accounts. And it doesn't mean the state of Connecticut is setting up a new pension system or a new retirement system that they're controlling. The state will act as a facilitator between private investment firms and employees to enable them to save for retirement at work in an individual private account that is owned by and controlled by the employee. And it would be voluntary for these employees. They would have the ability to opt out of doing this, but it would be required to be offered by the employers. So, you know, a lot of times people are saying, oh, this is, you know, the state can't manage its pension, they can't manage its budget. Well, the state wouldn't be doing either one of those things with these accounts. They're just kind of facilitating the relationship between the employees and the investment firms and allowing for this to happen through payroll deduction.
So the reason that this is so important, I guess, is because much like almost exactly mine, the average 401k account balance in Connecticut as of the last time the data was logged in 2012 was about just under $27,000. And I guess when folks have some sort of a retirement account that is either not supported by or partnering with an employer, the willingness or ability to contribute to it and keep that account robust is around 3%. But when it's being done through an employer and payroll deduction, even when there is no employer contribution, participation skyrockets into the 70% range, right?
Oh, you hit the nail right on the head, John. I mean, you know, we have volunteers that have been going around the state talking to Rotaries and civic groups, talking about the retirement savings crisis. And the one statistic that we like to say builds upon what you just said, which is that people are 15 times more likely to save for retirement if they can do it at work. That's 15 times. So, you know, yes, you can go into any bank and you can open up a 401k or an IRA or talk to any investment advisor, and you can do that. And we encourage people to do that because our objective is to really stem the retirement savings crisis. But the problem is that regardless of whether you can do it or not, people aren't. And a lot of the people that we're dealing with who aren't, who don't have the opportunity to do it at work are making $50,000 a year or less. And inertia is really what prevents them from going out and opening up one of these accounts. So, you know, we're trying to help nudge people to do the right thing, because the objective here, you know, and I often tell people, this is quite a conservative principle here. What we're doing is encouraging private savings in private accounts with private investors in order to prevent you from going into the social safety net system when you retire, because if you don't have enough to retire, you end up with food stamps, you end up with rental assistance, you end up with heating assistance. And, you know, we see the state of Connecticut's budget right now, and we're trying to kind of help stem that crisis in the future.
And this is this issue is something that does not affect just a few people, I guess, in Connecticut. There's I think you mentioned there's hundreds of thousands of workers that don't have access to workplace payroll deduction savings.
Yeah, I mean, over 600,000 and up to as high as 700,000, any number of different organizations that track these things will tell you that. And you know, you talked about the you know, some of the crisis, but, you know, with regards to how low people's 401k balances are, if you're so lucky to even have one, and you think about $26,000-$27,000 and living for maybe 25 to 35 more years after retirement, you know, you can't, you know, possibly survive on that. And, you know, when you look at the crisis in the nation as a whole with regards to retirement savings, people are, you know, we have a $7 trillion deficit in retirement savings from what people have saved versus what they'll need to retire. I mean, this is as big a crisis as any.
So some of the opposition I understand you're getting is the pushback against making the retirement savings opportunity mandatory.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it would be voluntary for the employees, meaning they can opt out. For the businesses that currently do not offer anything, they would be required to offer it, and it would be at little or no expense. If you use a payroll service, the payroll would take up the expense of whatever it is to deduct the payroll and direct it to the appropriate financial institution. But, you know, and that's really nominal, because it's like collecting for the United Way through payroll or your Social Security tax or income tax or anything else. It's just one more slot in the payroll. So it's not a big deal, and there might be some minor expenses, and those will be addressed for smaller businesses. But keeping in mind it's only five or more employees that are affected by this, and only those businesses that have nothing today. But at the end of the day, if we don't require those businesses to participate and we don't require people to have to opt out as to opposed to opt in, you cannot get the scale you need to contribute to what makes this successful. Because right now, businesses that aren't offering it are not offering it for a legitimate reason. It's too costly for them to offer, and, you know, the fees would be too high so that it wouldn't be worthwhile to either the employee with regards to the fees to manage the accounts, and the cost expense associated with administrating it for the employers would be too high. So what the state is doing is putting that onto the financial institutions that would actually manage these accounts. So an individual would have like a date certain fund. So if I'm retiring in 2035, I'd be in the 2035 fund, and there would be enough people to keep expenses down. And we're talking like, you know, a half to 1% of the account going towards managing it, which, you know, you can't possibly get anywhere else with the size accounts that we're talking about.
Okay. And some of the other issues are involving an alleged legal liability question.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people like to point to ERISA, which is a very complicated thing, and you know, which is something that actually is there to be a consumer protection to prevent there and provide a kind of a safe harbor for investment in retirement. You know, and this is something that we always felt was not an issue. The state of Connecticut is studied this with consultants who are specializing in this area for over 18 months and have created a plan that would not be in violation of federal law. And in fact, the president and the secretary of labor during this past year's White House conference on aging said not only would these types of plans not be illegal, but they're writing rules to actually make it more easy for states to engage in the activity that we're engaging in here in Connecticut, because that's how bad they see the crisis, you know, that we really need to address it. And so, you know, the federal rules are being written to enable this, not to prevent this. And as I say, Connecticut has looked this very, very thoroughly and better than any state has, who's actually already passed legislation to do this.
So when people are hearing, oh, you know, Connecticut doesn't really need this, the types of benefits that this bill can provide because of something that's known as MYRA?
Yeah, MYRA. You know, the president in last year's State of the Union address announced MYRA, which is my IRA, to kind of help address some of the issues to make it easier for people to save for in an IRA. The problem with it is that a MYRA account is capped at $15,000, and it's not portable. And it's capped at $15,000 simply because it's not a profitable account for the investment people. And it's capped at $15,000. And guess what happens after $15,000? You have to roll it over with a private investor, because now it becomes a profitable account to them, so now they want it. And, you know, the person who was involved in, starting their own MYRA account, you know, now has to deal with all these things they weren't prepared to deal with in the first place. So it's, you know, it's not a bad thing. As I said, you know, education is great. Education and financial literacy, we need MYRA, we need, you know, all of these things are important, but I go back to the statistic that I talked about before, which is that unless people are saving for retirement through payroll, they're not going to save, and the statistic that is 15 times more likely to save through payroll really bears out, you know, what our years and years of study have said on this issue. So we're really confident that you need all of those tools in the toolbox, but the big kahuna is, you know, saving through payroll.
Even with this push that's been escalating over the past 5 years to get people banking and getting people even down into the kindergarten and pre-K level, doing financial education, bringing it into college arenas, high schools, getting banks, literally putting working branches into high schools.
Yeah.
All of this is not enough. There's still a feeling that the initiation of this bill, if it is passed, will make a notable difference?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. All of those things are important. And, you know, the presentation, by the way, that our volunteers are making across the state focuses so much more on the crisis and alerting people to the notion that they need to save for retirement. You know, we're talking to younger audiences, colleges, and so forth. But yes, you know, without doing it through payroll, we just have a serious problem. And I go back to the notion that the people we're talking about are likely to be in lower wage jobs, because if you're in a higher wage job, chances are you may have a pension or you may have a 401k. But when you're in a lower wage job, you don't. And, you know, inertia and just life takes over, and chances are people are not, who are making $35,000 a year, going to walk into a bank and open up an IRA account.
Okay.
However, if they had it done automatically through payroll at work and had to opt out, chances are they would do it, and it would be good for them, and it's good for the state of Connecticut.
Right, because literally a penny saved is a penny earned in this case.
John, if you start with those people that you're talking about who are just getting out of high school and you know, or just out of college, 21,
yeah,
22, and they save whatever it is they can in an IRA, then the compounding effect is so huge at that stage that it's amazing how much money they'll be able to save. I mean, so, you know, we need all of the above, but once again, without this, you know, the crisis has been growing, and it'll continue to grow, and this is going to be the thing that I think stems the tide.
Okay. And I don't mean to pin you to just a minute, but we only have got about a minute and a half left to go.
Sure.
People are talking about programs in Washington State and New Jersey,
yep,
as being a possible better way than the initiative that's behind the House bill.
Well, and, you know, we're mirroring our legislation off of Illinois and what New Jersey originally passed in a bipartisan manner. What Illinois and other states are doing is creating a website, which, by the way, has an annual ongoing cost to those states to maintain, and doesn't take any of the administrative burden off the businesses, because, you know, any business who wants to can provide this today. The problem is that the administrative burdens are so great, and those burdens will still exist if the state creates a web portal that will list, you know, the kinds of plans available. So what we're trying to do is get that burden off of businesses. You know, so the website model in Washington State and what New Jersey eventually established is actually more of a burden for businesses who want to do this than what we're proposing, because the whole idea here is to take that burden off the small business and put it onto the private investors and then have the employee be in a better position in the long run.
Fantastic. Some complex conversation this morning, but we do invite folks back to any of our radio station websites or to our podcast site on iTunes if they'd like to replay and listen to a little bit more of the detail. We're talking about House Bill 5591, an act creating the Connecticut Retirement Security Program, with our guest this morning, John Erlinghauser, who is an advocacy specialist with AARP Connecticut. So, John, I guess if people believe in this, they need to get in touch with their lawmakers, and if for whatever reason they may oppose it, then I guess they would do the same. So we hope that your resource provided them with the necessary information to make the right choices and become advocates themselves, hopefully to get House Bill 5591 through the system and into law. So thank you for your time this morning. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.